Live Show on UK Health Radio. I'm Robin Daly, host for the show and founder of Yes to Life, the UK charity flying the flag for integrative medicine as a way to better meet the needs of those with cancer. For today's show, I'm delighted to be able to introduce the keynote speaker for the forthcoming Yes to Life conference on the 24th of September in central London. The conference title is Finding a Deeper Connection, and Steve Taylor, who's the author of 13 books around the subject of personal transformation, will be presenting the keynote session, Transformation Through Turmoil. Today, I'm speaking to Steve over the internet about his latest book, Extraordinary Awakenings. Hi Steve, a warm welcome to the Yes Life Show.
Hi Robin, great to be with you.
So you're what would be called a prolific author. 13 books out under your belt, and today we're going to be talking about your latest book. It's one I've been wanting to be there for a long time. In these shows, I'm really quite often talking about the phenomenon of people who come through cancer, or even those still living with cancer, who say, cancer's the best thing that ever happened to me. It doesn't make a lot of sense from the outside, and certainly anyone who has cancer and who's only experienced it as loss and suffering, it really looks a bit nuts. So your latest book, Extraordinary Awakenings, is a handbook to this territory, helping people to access the silver lining of suffering and existential threat. Mm. As you and many listeners are going to know, we set out to provide some inspiration regarding this terrain ourselves this September in the form of our annual conference, Finding a Deeper Connection. And I'm delighted to say, stumbled on you and your work, and you've kindly agreed to be our keynote speaker for the event, which is amazing. So one of the most exciting developments in personal transformation or awakening is that, I think, is finally ceasing to be the exclusive domain of kind of esotericism and religion, is now starting to be seen for what it truly is, accessible by anyone, and now even a part of our scientific understanding. So this, it seems to me, is where you operate, bringing what at first appears to be a bit mysterious, very distant, bringing it back to something accessible, understandable and rational. So would you like to introduce us to your work and say something about what motivates you in this direction?
Okay. Well, I'm interested in a field called transpersonal psychology, which investigates the overlap between spirituality and psychology. And as you suggested in your introduction, I've always been interested in spirituality kind of outside, well, certainly outside the context of religion, but also even outside the context of spiritual traditions. I've always been interested in spirituality as a, if you like, a psychological phenomenon.
Okay.
And also, I've always been fascinated by, well, two things really. The first is what I call awakening experiences. That's when for a short time, people have a glimpse of a wider reality, a more expansive reality. It's as if, you know, blinkers fall away and they suddenly see this more intense reality, this more beautiful and real reality. And, you know, it seems to be a glimpse of a truer, more complete world, you know, a world which normally we are hidden from by the limitations of our normal consciousness. So I've always been interested in those experiences, which I call awakening experiences. But even more than that, I've been interested in transformational experiences which become permanent, you know, shifts of identity when people undergo usually a traumatic experience of some form, like a diagnosis of cancer, but it could also be bereavement. It could be a long period of addiction or depression. It could be, you know, turbulent life events like divorce or unemployment. But those kind of traumatic experiences can sometimes have a positive transformational effect. That's what I call transformation through turmoil.
Right. TTT in your
TTT.
Book. Yeah, very good. So I'm assuming that you must have had some sort of personal awakening experience yourself to even get the idea there's a lot to talk about and it's worth writing about.
To an extent. I mean, I did have a brush with mortality about 15 years ago now. It was unfortunately the only time in my life when I was seriously, I had this strange phenomenon called a quinsy, which is like a kind of abscess. And it, And I went into hospital, and I got a bacterial infection in hospital that sort of tracked through my body. And the doctor, everyone was very worried about me. I was incredibly weak. I couldn't walk. I couldn't eat or drink. So it lasted for like three or 4 weeks. But when I began to recover, I felt so elated, and I felt so appreciative of everything. You know, I felt so appreciative of my body, you know, for undergoing all these miraculous healing processes. Mm. I felt so aware of all the amazing things that my body does every moment of the day to keep me healthy and alive and conscious. Mm. And I was just aware that life is probably the first time that I've really been acutely aware that life is a temporary, fragile and precious phenomenon.
Right,
and it just really hit me really strongly that, you know, that normally, in my normal circumstances, I took life for granted to a certain extent, hopefully not completely. But, you know, in the state of recovery from my illness, you know, I was just so aware of the miracle and the privilege of being alive, and all of the people in my life, you know, they became sort of temporary and precious beings as well. So everything took on a new perspective. And I thought it would fade away, but it didn't. You know, I think something remained permanently, obviously de-intensified. But it became, I think something of it remained permanently, a sense of appreciation and a sense of the fragility of life. Although I think I had sort of spiritual experiences before then as well. So this experience was kind of like a reminder of maybe a reminder of transformational possibilities.
Interesting, isn't it? Yeah, these things can tie together. There can be a string of things that can happen to somebody through their life, and each time it sort of brings them back to that point again and say, oh yes, right, I've seen this before, you know. And I think the interesting thing is that, you know, when you're describing it at the beginning, you get this more true view, and it's interesting how we know it's more true.
Yeah.
How it's not just that it's, you know, we think it's more true, but we actually know, oh yeah, this is actually what's going on. Why was I fooled into thinking it was any other way before, sort of thing, you know? It's curious, isn't it, that we can tell that?
Yeah, I mean, if you have a hallucination, or if you wake up from a dream, you know, you return to your normal consciousness and you know that it wasn't real, it was some kind of illusion. But when you return from these experiences, you know that you've experienced something very authentic, something more powerfully real than your normal awareness. That's why these experiences have a revelatory quality. You know, there's a sense that you're seeing through the veil almost. You're seeing things which are normally hidden. And it may not be, you know, what you see, you know, it's in some ways it's, you know, it's just an extension of what we already know. It's a sense of harmony, a sense of meaning, a sense, most of all, a sense of connection, maybe even a sense of oneness. So, yeah, it is a kind of reminder almost of what you already know deep down.
Hmm. The other thing I thought was quite interesting, what you just said, is the way you differentiated between the experience at the time and the lasting effect, which is not the same thing. It's not like you're in that place all the time. But your perspective is slightly different because of the experience you've had. It can have this permanent change. So they're different things, aren't they? I mean, I get a feeling like in the spiritual world, that, you know, people have a spiritual experience and then they're just desperate to get back to that place again, you know, and they'll kill themselves meditating for decades to get back to that place. But in a way, the change you're talking about is not being anywhere different to where you are, but seeing things differently.
That's right. Yeah, I actually did a study of awakening experiences. I looked into the after effects. Awakening experiences are the experiences which are temporary. You know, they may last for a few seconds, maybe a few minutes, maybe a few hours if you're lucky. But you know, there's a sudden sense of expansion and intensification, and you realize that there is more to the world than you believed. You know, and those experiences they normally have positive after effects. They give people a sense of positivity in their lives. They make people more humble because they realize that there is more to the world than they expected. And, you know, they give them a sense of trust and a feeling of purpose because, you know, they know that that realm is there and they want to return to it. So, I mean, sometimes that happens, you know, during when you're in contact with nature, maybe walking in the countryside. It can happen after a meditation. It can also happen after a traumatic experience. But in a small number of cases, it has the opposite effect. People feel frustrated because they want to get back there. They feel trapped in ordinary reality.
Yeah.
And they want to, they feel frustrated and they're desperate to get back to that place. Which, of course, you can't. The more you want to get back there, you know, the less successful you are.
I think that's the way it works, yeah. Interesting. So, one of the things we found in the kind of lead up to our conference and, you know, writing stuff about what we're planning to include as the content and everything, is I found the language quite hard, because all the most suitable words that seem to be the ones you want to use, of course, are absolutely steeped in preconceptions and misconceptions. And the chances of communicating something you didn't mean to some of the people you're trying to talk to seem to be enormous. I mean, how have you tackled that with in your writings and everything? Do you find it's an issue?
It is an issue with the word spiritual. When I first started doing research, I wanted to ask people about these kinds of experiences of spiritual transformation or spiritual experiences. But people have, the word spiritual means something different to every single person. You know,
exactly.
Some people talk about religious experiences, having a vision of Jesus. Some people talk about psychic experiences, seeing a ghost, and, you know, all under the umbrella term of spiritual.
Yes.
So I these days, I actually try to avoid the term spiritual. And so I don't talk about spiritual experiences. I talk about awakening experiences.
That's why, makes sense.
It's particularly with religion, you know, I respect all religions, but, you know, religion and spirituality aren't necessarily the same thing. You get a lot of sort of fundamentalist religious people who are not spiritual at all.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, and you get a lot of non-religious people who are very spiritual.
Yeah. So I think it's very important to make clear this division, is that, you know, we want to do this with our event. We want to make quite clear this is nothing whatsoever to do with religion, and it's fine if you've got a religion, but it's also fine if you haven't. So it's actually nothing to do with that. It's about people, basically. It's about human beings and the human experience. So and the challenges that people with cancer share and the opportunities they share, which, you know, you described your own situation there, where suddenly you have a brush with death and perspective comes in the door like never before, you know, because you realize your own mortality. And
I think most people tend to take life for granted. You know, we don't realize that we are mortal beings. You know,
it's not the way we're taught to live. Nobody goes anywhere near death. I didn't see anybody dead till I was about 35 or 40.
Yeah,
you know? So it's not part of our lives. We all pretend that we're going to live forever, and we live like that, you know.
I know, it's crazy. Yeah, it's partly cultural. You know, in other cultures in the world, they have a more open attitude to death. But Buddhist monks practice cemetery meditations. That they go to the cemeteries to meditate.
I hear that. Yeah. Well, and a good reason why. Obviously, they're being encouraged to get real.
they're just reminding themselves of the process that they will undergo, and they're reminding themselves of the fragility of life and the meaninglessness of accumulating riches and, you know, the meaninglessness of, you know, being attached to too many things in this world.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Nagging pain. We at Alka-Seltzer know that a small amount of the patient's own bone marrow and blood cells can treat many painful conditions with regenerative orthopedic therapy. This is an attractive treatment option for painful joints, back pain, sports injuries, and many other conditions. It may avoid the need for surgery altogether. Alka-Seltzer, part of a network of 50 RegenX clinics worldwide, where over 60,000 patients have been treated and helped. Alka-Seltzer. Life is more beautiful with less pain.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
You know, it seems to me you're basically, you're intent on demystifying this process, which far too long it's been seen as right out of reach of all us ordinary mortals. So I actually love what you're doing for that reason, because it really is true that anybody, you know, and particularly people who are in the heightened awareness that goes with an existential threat, i.e. people with cancer, are in a very good position to take, you know, to be open to this kind of change, an opportunity.
Yeah.
But it's a hard thing to say to somebody when they're faced with cancer, isn't it? Oh, yeah, this is a great opportunity. Yeah, come on. They're going to get a punch in the face. So finding a way of communicating this that is respectful and actually does create an opportunity is hard, I think, for this kind of situation.
I think so. I mean, you don't want to put pressure on people. You don't want to make people feel more negative about themselves, you know, if they haven't undergone this kind of process of transformation.
Right.
I guess that's the difficulty.
Yeah.
But it's definitely a possibility. And to some extent, it does depend on, you know, your attitude towards your predicament. And, you know, I think there are certain personality traits which make people more open to these kind of processes of transformation. Mm. I had a friend of mine actually who had undergone his own transformation. He was an alcoholic who underwent a transformation following his addiction, you know, through following the 12-step process in AA.
Yeah.
And he retrained as a therapist and worked at Christie's Hospital in Manchester.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that he always knew when somebody was going to have some sort of process of positive transformation.
Really?
Amongst the patients he saw. He said he could sense it, right. You know, whether it was going to happen.
Right. That's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, you know, the nearest I can get to that is that I spent a lot of time with the families of children who got cancer. Staying in a kind of hostel, which was there in order to... the third parents could stay near the hospital where they're being treated. And to me, I could divide the parents up into two groups very neatly. There's one group who are amazing. They were completely switched on by the situation they were in. They were right there for it. And the others said, "Why is this happening to me?" was their attitude. And they were like, "Yeah, okay, we'll leave those people over there. The other people, yeah, these are the people I want to be with." But they were, it's like night and day. There weren't people in between. They literally divided them into two groups. They were either self-concerned or they were utterly unself-concerned.
Yeah, that's similar to what my friend said. He said he based it on sort of whether someone had a controlling personality, whether they were willing to step back and kind of open themselves to their predicament.
Mm.
So people with a more controlling kind of personality, who are kind of, you know, really fighting in an egoic way and not willing to open themselves to their predicament, they were less likely to undergo a positive transformation.
Makes sense, because it's not something you're doing, it's something that's happening to you. So if you're trying to be in control, you're trying to stop that kind of thing, essentially, aren't you?
That's right. Mm-hmm.
So coming back to your book. In this, you pay particular attention to the role that suffering and hugely challenging life circumstances can play in what you called, so eloquently, transformation through turmoil, TTT. So that's what makes your work so uniquely relevant to the subject of this show, of cancer, because cancer, of course, has got an uncanny way of bringing an awareness of our mortality into sharp focus very rapidly. So much of your work centred on interviewing people with a personal experience of TTT. Were some of those actually people facing cancer, or family of, or closely associated?
Certainly, yeah. One of the first people I interviewed was a lady called Irene, who was diagnosed with cancer, breast cancer, at the age of 43, I think she was. And she was quite remarkable because she underwent a transformation straight away, you know, as soon as she was diagnosed.
Wow. Right.
And it was to do with death. She said when I interviewed her, it was the first time I'd ever been aware of the reality of a death. Just knocked her for six. but in a positive way. She said that she was just so aware of the miracle of life in the moment. She said that she walked out of the consulting room and was just amazed at the reality of everything, how beautiful and vivid and fresh everything seemed. She said that she could see this kind of energy vibrating in the air, a kind of radiance vibrating in the air.
Fantastic.
It just hit her straight away with a very powerful force. And she thought, wow, this is just a kind of high that will fade away. But it didn't, it did de-intensify, but it remained a lower level of intensity. And she felt paradoxically, even though she'd been diagnosed with cancer, she felt incredibly, incredibly lucky to have been given this heightened awareness, this glimpse of reality.
Right. It's very interesting that the direct connection between the being open to your own mortality also lets in the door to the other side. It's like, we have a bandwidth control, which we normally go through life with this very narrow bandwidth, trying to keep away all the really bad things, but that also keeps away the whole really good thing, because we've narrowed our experience down so much.
Mm.
And you open up on one side and suddenly, bam, there she is talking about all this incredible view she has of how precious life is and how wonderful it is, which she hadn't seen before. It's really interesting, isn't it?
Mm, that's right, yeah. And it changed everything in her life. She gave up her job. She had been a kind of, I think she was a marketing executive for a pharmaceutical company, very, very kind of driven professional person.
Yeah.
But she immediately stepped back and retrained as a counselor and a therapist, and everything changed. Her whole value system changed. She shifted to
amazing,
a less materialistic lifestyle, which is quite common. Most people who go through this transformation, whether it's through cancer or through bereavement or addiction, they often shift to a simpler, less materialistic lifestyle, one which is based on altruism rather than, getting and spending.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So, the fascinating thing is, of course, this is actually one person. It's not a different person, but it's that one person, what happens to them, if you like, when some of the constraints are removed. The box they normally live in, if you like, has been torn away.
Yeah.
Maybe quite brutally, but nonetheless, they're suddenly expressing something and interested in something very different.
That's right. In fact, that the metaphor of the box was used by one person I spoke to, one person I interviewed. That was a person who underwent a transformation after a bereavement, after her friend was murdered.
Oh, wow.
And she said it was like a box falling away, as if she'd lived her whole life in a box. And suddenly she had this sense of openness, this sense of possibility and opportunity, and this awareness of more information, more reality, which was sort of flooding into her mind.
Right.
So I think a lot of people have that feeling. And there's, I think, one of the most common aspects of the transformation that people go through, and this is particularly true of the people who've been diagnosed with cancer. It's the birth of a new authenticity within them.
Right.
They begin to live in a much more authentic way, rather than pleasing other people, rather than following convention.
Mm-hmm.
They feel that they're living from a deeper, more authentic place.
Mm. Well, that's a great description. I was just describing the fact that it's the same person, but they're behaving quite differently and their perspectives are quite different. And really, that's a great way to describe what's happened to them. So they've become authentic, which, of course, implies that before they weren't, in fact, when they were in their box. They were complying with what's expected, trying to fit in, trying to be liked, all those things that human beings expend far too much energy on. We all do that.
That's right. Although they were procrastinating, postponing their lives, not fulfilling their deepest desires or not following their deepest impulses.
Mm-hmm.
And so one woman who was diagnosed with cancer, she started to live from this more authentic place, and she decided she was going to do all the things that she'd always wanted to but been too afraid to do, like going away on holiday on her own or going paragliding and things like that.
Great.
And this is wonderful. And she started writing poetry too, because she'd always had this secret desire to write poetry. So that's quite common.
Yeah. Yeah, in a way, this is, other people can recognize this kind of potential in somebody more easily than they recognize it in themselves. If it's somebody you like and love, I think you could experience it as them really being themselves and living in a really fulfilled way, authentic, like you said. And, you know, they suddenly actually stop limiting themselves, you know, for whatever reasons they do, and start expressing and pursuing the things that really are them.
That's right. Although sometimes the people around them may actually resent that.
No, it's true. Some people
they sometimes perceive as a kind of selfishness. Like the woman I just mentioned, she'd always sort of lived for a family, for a husband and her children. And they thought, oh, what's happened to mum? You know, why is she doing all these things for herself?
Yeah.
Why is she being so selfish? But of course, it's not selfishness. It's authenticity.
Yeah, very different. But you're right. Of course, change is scary for other people as well. Some people love it. Other people are scared by it, basically.
Yeah, that they have to adjust as well. You know, if they're not willing to adjust, then it can cause issues.
Yeah. Anyway, that's part of the price of, in a way, of being authentic, is that you might lose a few friends, and they're probably not the most serious connections you ever had. In fact, it probably shows up the weaknesses that are already there.
Mm. Yeah.
So back to the book, you've divided up into chapters about the various common scenarios that got the power to promote what is now described as post-traumatic growth. So while today we're really focusing on just one of these, it'd be quite interesting to have a quick overview of all the different territory describing each of the circumstances that you've selected to devote a chapter to.
Mm-hmm. Well, I began with warfare, because I found a lot of examples of transformation amongst soldiers, particularly in the stress and terror of, you know, on the battlefield, when there was a potential that they might die, or when they confronted death in their, you know, their fellow soldiers or in their perceived enemies. And particularly, you know, when people go through years of exposure to that kind of turmoil, and, you know, the possibility of mortality, it can build up into a long and gradual transformation. So I found a lot of examples of that amongst ex-soldiers, people who'd emerged through PTSD into post-traumatic growth or transformation through turmoil. Then I looked into prisoners. I found a lot of cases of prisoners who underwent transformation.
Wow.
I found that was surprisingly common, probably because in prison, there's a lot of inactivity and solitude. So a lot of people, well, many people are forced to confront themselves in a way that they've never done before. They're forced to explore themselves in a way that they've never done. And for many people, that's painful. But for others, it can sort of make them aware of a new dimension of themselves, a new dimension of their being, a deeper level of their own self. So a lot of prisoners undergo that experience. Also in prison, you have to let go of everything, you know, everything which gives your life meaning is outside the prison. So that's quite powerful as well. Then I looked into addiction. I found that it's not uncommon for people to undergo a sudden transformation after many years of addiction. And that's probably because addiction is a long process of loss, you know. It's a long process of being forced to let go of everything which defines you. So that's often, a painful experience. But in some people, it seems to allow a deeper self to arise. Then I looked into cancer. I had a chapter on cancer and other forms of encounters with death. I looked into near-death experiences, which is, you know, in the most specific sense, a near-death experience is when a person is clinically dead for a short time and they have an experience of seeming to leave their bodies, and occasionally they perceive themselves traveling through a tunnel towards light and so on. Those experiences are well known. But everyone who goes through that experience undergoes a powerful transformation.
Right. You said everyone there quite convincingly. So that's true, is it? It's without exception, people who have that experience are changed.
Almost without exception. It's probably only a very small minority of people who don't go through transformation. And if they don't, it's usually because they don't know how to make sense of the experience. They can't it doesn't fit into their view of reality. Sometimes they repress it because they don't understand it.
That's very interesting, that one. That I feel is why this stuff needs to come out of the closet, so that I think it's actually probably more common than we think, that people have had an experience like this, think they've gone nuts, or, you know, I can't tell anybody else about this, and so they literally sort of tuck it away, where it's actually the greatest thing that ever happened to them, you know? Exactly. But they don't understand it and haven't got a context for it. It doesn't fit.
Yeah, that's a big issue. I mean, I can't tell you the number of people I spoke to who said, oh, at the beginning, I thought I was crazy. And other people told me I was crazy. It was only later on that they began to make sense of it. Yeah. They began to establish a framework to understand it.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Nagging pain. We at Alka-Seltzer know that a small amount of the patient's own bone marrow and blood cells can treat many painful conditions with regenerative orthopedic therapy. This is an attractive treatment option for painful joints, back pain, sports injuries, and many other conditions. It may avoid the need for surgery altogether. Alka-Seltzer, part of a network of 50 RegenX clinics worldwide, where over 60,000 patients have been treated and helped. Alka-Seltzer. Life is more beautiful with less pain.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
The station that makes you feel good.
So there are a couple of things in what you've just said that are interesting. One of them is there are two, you know, things don't happen the same for everybody. And there's some transformations which are seemingly almost instant, like the lady who got diagnosed with cancer. And other ones you're saying actually happen over a long period of time. So that's quite interesting. It's kind of not a one-size-fits-all process, but it can be different for different people.
That's true. It's a bit like, I think these experiences are basically due to what you could call ego dissolution, you know, the sort of the collapse of a normal person's normal identity.
Yeah.
And that can happen very suddenly, like an earthquake that knocks a house down. Or it can happen very gradually over a number of years, you know, just as if you were sort of slowly removing bricks from a house. Mm. Eventually the house will collapse when a certain number of bricks have been taken away.
Right, right. Very interesting, because, that would describe exactly like the addict or whatever you were saying, getting things taken away. They're gradually, their ego is being dissolved by their addiction. And it's interesting that, in a way, that is a preparation for being ready for something else, is that your normal framework of your views of the life and yourself are actually falling away bit by bit, and you're becoming open to something else, really. Your normal defences against reality, if you like, are beginning broken down one way or another.
Exactly.
There's a phrase that somebody used on the radio once, which always stuck with me. I thought it was really good. He said, "I've been to the bottom and I can report that it's firm." Which is very telling, I think, because he was saying there, you know, he'd been right to the bottom, which means he had lost everything. But he found that when he got to the bottom, he was standing on reality, something solid, whereas the rest of his life up to that point, he'd been making it up, you know, is his own fantasy, if you like, he lived in. Yeah. So fascinating. I think that's such a telling little saying. That
one. Yeah, that's great. Yeah, that's very, very true.
Okay. So we talked about these different elements, these different doorways, if you like, to transformative experience. But the aspects that tie them all together and make them clearly much more than a singular personal experience, and clearly more of an evolutionary step. Those can we dig into those a little bit now? Because that's what you're, one of the biggest things you're interested in, I think. Well, what's going on here? These aren't just random things that happen to some people and that have got nothing to do with each other. There's a lot in common. So can we talk about the factors in common?
I see it as the emergence of a more expansive awareness of reality. And it's basically fundamentally the same experience which spiritual people go through. You know, you get monks who meditate for decades, or yogis who follow a spiritual path, or Buddhists who follow the Eightfold Path of Buddhism. They all, you know, they're all moving in a certain direction towards a more expansive awareness of reality, which they interpret according to their own traditions.
Yeah.
My feeling is that the people I interview, the people who go through transformation through turmoil, go through essentially the same process in an accidental way.
Right.
You know, it's completely spontaneous and accidental, but they find the same kind of heightened awareness which people try to cultivate through spiritual practice.
Yeah.
Actually, there was a guy I interviewed who, he underwent a transformation following deep stress and depression, and he went to a Buddhist monastery and spoke to the kind of the head guy at the monastery.
Yeah.
And he said, "Don't talk too loudly about this, because everyone's trying to get what you've found, you know. So everyone in the monastery is trying to get what you found accidentally."
Yeah, right.
But so yeah, it is it's a more expansive awareness of reality. And I do sort of interpret it in an evolutionary sense, that evolution, the evolution of life on this planet, is, it has a physical dimension, obviously. You know, living beings become more complex physically. They develop in different variations and so forth. But evolution also has an inner dimension, that life forms become more aware, they become more sentient, and gradually they become self-conscious, and they develop a more intricate awareness of reality or of the world. Mm. So I think spiritual experiences, awakening experiences, or transformation through turmoil is moving in the same direction towards a more expansive awareness. So I think it's a part of, it's growth. It's about the growth of consciousness within human beings.
Right. Okay. So one of the things about the accidental kind is that, well, you can't tell anybody else, oh yeah, you were going to have an accident like me, or get cancer like me either. You know, these things, they happen to people, and they're usually unwelcome, in fact, these things, but it's the way that they're received by that person that has the potential, if you like. Now, the people are sitting down meditating for 25 years. They're intentionally doing something because to reach that thing. But it seems like there are plenty of intentional routes as well. There seem to be things you can do intentionally. And other than that, I mean, one of the ones that's right in the news a lot at the moment is, of course, using psilocybin to help people who are majorly depressed. And, you know, the big news is what an extraordinary effect it can have with very little exposure, you know, 1, 2, 3 sessions. And somebody who's deeply traumatized or deeply depressed can be lifted out of it, and their whole view changed. So that to me could only happen if it was one of these experiences. I've never had any psilocybin or anything else like it, so I'm not talking from personal experience, but presumably that is what's made those kind of approaches actually built into some cultures as a kind of rite of passage for young people growing up, to give them a view of reality, if you like, to set them on the right path for their life. And quite a sensible one, it sounds like to me, but...
I think so.
Would you agree that actually this also is pointing towards the same kind of transformation potentially?
Certainly, yeah. I think one difference between our culture and other cultures is that in our culture, we believe that normal consciousness or normal reality is absolute reality. We believe there is nothing more, that this is the way things are, you know, this is reality. Whereas other cultures, they believe that there are different realities or other levels of reality. You know, they believe in realities beyond this everyday reality. So when they take psychedelic substances, it is a way of making contact with these higher or different levels of reality. And I think that applies to us, to an extent as well, because, you know, if a person takes psilocybin or ayahuasca or LSD, in the right circumstances, it can give them a glimpse of a wider, more intense, more expansive reality, which, you know, a reality of beauty and harmony and isness and connection. You know, it can give them a feeling that they are connected to everything, or give them a sense that everything is interconnected. And once you have that glimpse, you know, as we were saying before, it's so authentic, it's so real, you can't forget it. You know, you know that it is reality.
Right.
And you have a sense that you have an awareness that your everyday reality is not necessarily the truth. You know, so it changes your perspective. It makes you more humble. It brings in a sort of new philosophical or spiritual dimension to your life, and it makes you feel more positive because you've seen meaning, you know, so you're less likely to fall into depression.
Right. Interestingly enough, I feel like we were talking earlier about the fact that people want to get back to where they have an experience like that, they want to get back there again. Well, the method, the means, the doorway, whatever you want to call it, of getting to that experience can turn into a trap, it seems to me. And that could be meditation, which you waste years on, in a way, or it could be drugs, which you go back to the same drug over and over again. They're both, in a way, a bit of a trap to when actually this is something that all the spiritual traditions talk about. You're not trying to get somewhere. It's not. It's not somewhere else or outside yourself or anything else, you know. And therefore, all the efforts you're putting into it in the end, or the intention you're putting into it in the end, needs to be given up. And the only purpose of the intention is in order to decide you've actually done it, and it's not worth trying anymore.
I mean, that's certainly true of psychedelics. Yeah, I like what Alan Watts said about psychedelics.
Okay.
He said, once you get the message, hang up. In other words, you don't need to keep doing it. If you get the message once, that's enough.
Right.
Why do it again? You know, you've seen the meaning or the reality. And I think some people do fall into that trap. They think that psychedelics are kind of a route to enlightenment when they're not really.
They
give you a glimpse of it, but they don't show you how to get there.
Right. Right.
You know, you can keep repeating the experience, but you know, it doesn't normally come to fruition, and there are some negative aspects as well.
Yeah.
But I think meditation is a much healthier way of doing it.
True. I would agree with that, but it's interesting though, because I think this brings us back to what we were talking about at the beginning, the difference between the experience and the effect that experience can have on the way you live and the way you see things. And they're not the same thing, are they? You don't actually. The aim is not to create a permanent version of that experience, because I don't know of anybody who's ever done that. That's not a great result. A great result is somebody who sees their life in a very different way, like the lady you described who got a cancer diagnosis, and from then onwards she saw her whole life completely differently. That's a transformation. Okay, she didn't go around having a spiritual experience 24/7, I'm sure, but you know, that is it's really important to distinguish between the two, isn't it?
That's right. I mean, a lot of people think it's impossible to function, you know, once you've had a spiritual awakening of some form. They think that it makes it impossible to function in the world on a day-to-day basis, because you've got to keep driving the car and paying the bills and doing the jobs and so forth. But I don't think that's necessarily true, because I know I've interviewed many, many people who've undergone this kind of transformation and do manage to keep going on a daily basis.
Yeah.
Because it's not always in the foreground. It's kind of in the background, but you can still focus your mind on what needs to be done.
Mm.
But you have this background awareness, this background sense of perspective.
Right.
Which is always there, you know, if you want to tune into it again.
Yeah. Anyway, that I think is a bit of some kind of spiritual mumbo jumbo, that stuff about what enlightened people are like. You know, I don't know. It doesn't appeal to me at all. You actually put something in your book, I noticed, where you talk about new self, not no self. And that, again, is like, that's cutting through the crap, I think, and getting to actually the reality of what happens to people, not the ideas about it that are around, particularly in the spiritual world.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, there are a lot of spiritual teachers who talk about no self. They believe that the self is an illusion.
Yeah.
That if you undergo an awakening, it simply means that you let go of the illusion of self, you know. So they believe that there isn't really nothing there. There's just experience passing through you with no central place for you to sort of observe that experience. But that I think that's just sophistry, really. You know, when it comes down to it.
Me too.
people obviously have a sense of self. Yeah. You know, you can't function in the world without a sense of self.
Yeah.
But it's a different self.
It's a healthy sense of self, which is kind of makes room for finding out as well. It's not a fixed idea about who you are that can't do this and can do this and all the rest of it. You're finding out who you are day by day, I think, rather than than prescribing who you are in advance.
That's right. And I would say that it's a connected sense of self. You know, I sometimes compare it to, You know, imagine a big city like New York or London which is kind of separate from the landscape that it's a part of, and it's separate from the countryside. It's kind of an entity in itself.
Yes.
But compare that to something like an eco town, which blends into the landscape, which is connected to the landscape.
Yeah.
You can't really tell where the landscape ends or where it begins, but it's still there. There's still a town there. It's just not separate in the way it was before.
Yeah. All right. Well, look, we're running out of time already. I do want to talk about one more thing, which is very relevant to our conference. So this radical shift in outlook that comes with the transformative experience, it's probably the greatest blessing anybody could hope for. But you go on further to describe how through the inseparability of the body, mind and spirit, it can go further to affect our physical state of health. Now, that's really interesting. So we at Yesterlife, we're into integrative health, and integrative health means the broadest possible view of what health means. Now, this is in our reasoning, if you like, for bringing in this whole rather seemingly esoteric area into cancer care and believing it is part of cancer care. In fact, it's part of wellness, full stop, I would say. But we're talking about cancer, and there are particular opportunities in cancer for people to look at this stuff. So it seems to me that our spiritual state, if you want to use that term, could be either an obstacle to our health or a key component of our recovery. So I wonder if you'd like to say something about that.
Well, I mean, one of the strangest phenomena I investigated in my book was is people who'd been, you know, carrying around certain ailments or illnesses for a long time, like chronic digestive problems or chronic back problems, other issues. And once they underwent this transformation, the issues would spontaneously disappear.
Yeah.
And that, the way I would explain that is in terms of psychosomatic conditions. Like, a lot of illnesses are to a certain extent psychosomatic. So once a person undergoes a transformation, that they have a different psyche, a different kind of mind. And, you know, so often the conditions which created the ailment or the illness are no longer there. So it seems to miraculously clear up. And I think the important point to bear in mind here is that mind and body are not separate. You know, according to the sort of standard materialistic view in our culture, the mind is a product of the body, basically. It's a product of the brain. The mind has no independent existence, or basically has no existence, really. It's just a product of brain cells whirling around, creating the illusion of consciousness or creating the illusion of thoughts or hopes or dreams and so forth. So from that point of view, the mind should not be able to influence the body, because the mind is just a kind of shadow of the brain. So a shadow cannot influence a thing it's a shadow of. You know, a shadow of a body cannot influence the body itself. But there's so much evidence from science that, you know, this is not the case, that the mind does have a major influence over the body. We see this all the time in the placebo effect.
Exactly.
It's evident under hypnosis too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, under hypnosis, certain sort of healing possibilities become evident, or analgesic properties become evident. So the mind does seem to be able to influence the body to a large degree. And, you know, You can go into the philosophical background of this. My philosophy would be that the body and mind are essentially of the same substance. Mm-hmm. You know, and in some ways, the mind is a more primary thing than the body, because it's difficult to explain, but there's certain sort of philosophical reasons for that. So in actual fact, the mind has a powerful influence over the body, and your mental attitudes and also, you know, your mental intentions, in theory and in reality, do have or can have a healing effect on the body to some degree.
Right. So, you know, there is certainly more emphasis being placed on people looking at the kind of psychological, emotional realm if they've got a serious disease like cancer and they need to survive. And that they could overlook something very important, like the fact that their will to live is not particularly good, for example. You know, there are these things which people live with normally and don't even notice, maybe, but they become unveiled by a situation like cancer. So I think that's an increasingly kind of mainstream thing to talk about. But the extra step, if you like, which we're taking with this conference and which is the world you explore, of saying, oh, the spiritual realm as well, for want of a better word, not the best one, or the aspect of our connectedness to each other and to nature and to everything, is also extremely important to include in the opportunity of cancer, if you like, which takes you it gives you the chance to reevaluate everything about yourself and your life in a way that few other things do. So that's why we wanted to do this conference. And I hope people are going to turn up and love it, you know, because
sure they will.
I think there's just so much for people there on offer, and particularly what you're going to bring to us, because this is what you live.
Yeah. Yeah, we can never underestimate the power of mental attitudes and mental intentions, and we can never underestimate the power of the mind over the body.
Right. Good. Well, okay. Well, you know what? We have to end it there. We're out of time. It was ridiculously hard narrowing down the things I wanted to talk to you about today to something that might fit into 45 minutes for this interview. I actually failed dismally in the attempt. But I want to underline how personally excited and delighted I am to have found you and to be able to feature you and your absolutely invaluable work here in this show and also at our conference in September. So thank you very much indeed, Steve.
Thank you, Robin. Yeah, I'm looking forward to the conference as well.
Great. Cheers.
All right, cheers. Bye. Robin. Thank you. Bye.
If you're not already booked for the Yes to Life annual conference, Finding a Deeper Connection, then don't hang around. Go to the Yes to Life website, that's yestolife.org.uk, and click the button in the revolving banner at the top of the homepage when the conference ad comes around. This will take you to the dedicated conference website where you can read more about the event and the amazing lineup of speakers and, of course, book your place. Thanks for listening today. I'll be back again next week, so I hope you'll join me again for another Yes to Life show here on UK Health Radio. Goodbye. Thank you.